Chapter 5. Tuesday's Double Trouble. Visitors and Rioters. As a parent, I surely would not let my son continue in such a place if I saw such exhaustion and obvious signs of stress after only 3 days. Contemplating ways to cope with that impending challenge had to take a back seat to the more urgent issue of the rumored break-in by rioters that 8612 could bring down upon us at any time. Perhaps it would come today, maybe even synchronized with visiting hours when we would be most vulnerable. The day is just beginning for the morning shift at 2 a.m. Apparently the night shift has hung around, and all 6 guards are on the yard at the same time, after they had conferred in the guards' quarters about the need for stricter rules to control the prisoners and prevent more rebellions. Seeing them all together makes clear that size does matter in deciding who will emerge as shift leader. The tallest guards are Hellman, leader of the night shift, Vandy, moving into leadership of the morning shift, and Arnett, day shift major domo. The shortest guards, Burdan and Saros, have become henchmen of their shift leaders. Both are very bossy, quite aggressive vocally, shouting in the prisoners' faces, and decidedly more physical with the prisoners. They push them around, poke them, pull them out of lineups, and are the ones who drag reluctant prisoners into solitary. We are getting reports that they sometimes trip prisoners down the stairs when walking them to the toilet, or push them into the wall urinals when they are alone with them in the bathroom. It is evident that they love their nightsticks. They are constantly holding the billy clubs close to their chests, banging them against the bars and the doors or on the table to loudly make their presence known. Some analysts might claim that they are using their weapons to compensate for their smaller stature. But whatever the psychological dynamic involved, it is clear that they are becoming the meanest of the guards. However, Marcus and Varnish, who are also on the shorter side, have been relatively passive, much quieter, less vocal, and less active than the rest. I have asked the warden to make them more assertive. The Landry brothers are an interesting pair. Jeff Landry is a bit taller than Hellman and has vied with him for dominance on the night shift, but he is no match for the creative exercises that our budding John Wayne continually concocted. Instead, he moves in to give orders and to exercise control, then drifts back and out of the scene over and over again in a kind of vacillation that's not seen in any other guard. Tonight he is not carrying his nightstick at all. Later on, he even removes his silver reflecting sunglasses, a big no-no according to our experimental protocol. His shorter brother John has been tough on the prisoners, but he is nevertheless going by the book. He is not aggressively excessive, as Arnett is, but he does usually back up the boss with firm, no-nonsense orders. The prisoners are all about the same average height, about 5'8 to 5'10, except for Glenn, 3401, who is the shortest of all, around 5'2, and tall Paul, 5704, who is tallest at maybe 6'2". Interestingly, 5704 is moving into the leadership position among the prisoners. He appears more self-confident lately and assured in his rebelliousness. His mates have noticed this change in him, as was evidenced by their electing him spokesperson for the Stanford County Jail Prisoners Grievance Committee, which had earlier negotiated with me for a series of concessions and rights. New rules, but old counts continue. For yet another count at 2:30 a.m., the yard is a bit crowded, with 6 guards present and 7 prisoners lined up against the wall. Even though there is no reason for the night shift to hang around longer, they do so on their own. Maybe they want to check out how the morning shift handles their routine. 8612 is gone, and someone else is missing. Vandy drags the reluctant, sleepy prisoner 819 out of cell 2 to complete the lineup. The guards are berating some prisoners for not wearing their stocking caps, reminding them that they are an essential part of their prison uniform. Vandy. Here it is. Time for the count. How do you like that? One prisoner says, Fine, Mr. Correctional Officer. How about the rest of you? Sarge. Wonderful, Mr. Correctional Officer. Let's hear it from all of you. Come on. You can do it better than that. Louder. Just fine, Mr. Correctional Officer. Louder. What time is it?
Time for a count, Mr. Correctional Officer.
One prisoner answers in a weak voice. The prisoners are all lined up against the wall, hands against the wall, legs spread apart. They are clearly sluggish, counting this early because they have slept only a few hours. Even though his shift time is over, Burdan is still being very assertive, shouting orders as he stalks around, waving his big stick. He pulls someone out of line randomly. "Okay, young man, you gonna do some push-ups for me?" he shouts. Now Varnish speaks up for the first time.
"Okay, let's have your numbers, starting with the right. Now."
Maybe he feels more confident among a larger group of guards. Then Jeff Landry gets into the act.
"Wait a minute, this guy over here, 7258, doesn't even know his number backwards."
But why is Jeff still active on this next shift? He walks around with his hands in his pockets, more like an uninvolved tourist than a prison guard. In fact, why is the whole night shift continuing to hang around after a long, tedious night? They should be on their way to bed now. Their presence is causing confusion and uncertainty about who should be giving orders. The counts follow the same formerly clever routines that are now becoming tedious. By twos, by ID numbers, backward, and sing-song variations. Hellman, having decided that this is not his cup of tea, says nothing, watches for a while, and then quietly exits. The old rules are repeated, and they too are to be sung. As the rule reading goes on, Vandy exhorts the inmates to be louder, faster, crisper. The weary prisoners comply, their voices blending in dissonant synchrony. It is time for some new rules, so the guards, on their own, add some.
Prisoners must participate in all prison activities. That means counts. Beds must be made and personal effects must be neat and orderly. Floors must be spotless. Prisoners must not move, tamper with, or deface walls, ceilings, windows, doors, or any other prison property.
Varnish has set up this drill that the prisoners must understand perfectly well in both substance and style. If they do a half-hearted job, he simply forces them to repeat the rules over and over again in mind-numbing variations. Varnish.
Prisoners must never operate cell lighting.
Prisoners.
Prisoners must never operate cell lighting.
Vandy.
When must prisoners operate cell lighting?
Prisoners, now in perfect unison.
Never!
They all sound exhausted, but their responses are crisper and louder than they were last night. All of a sudden, Varnish has become a leader. He's leading the recitation of the rules, insisting upon perfection from the prisoners, exerting dominance over them, and patronizing them. A new rule is proclaimed that is obviously geared to taunt Paul, 5704, our nicotine addict. Varnish.
Smoking is a privilege.
Prisoners.
Smoking is a privilege.
What is smoking?
A privilege.
What?
A privilege.
Smoking will be allowed only after meals or at the discretion of the guard.
Varnish.
I don't like this monotone. Let's go up the scale.
The prisoners comply, repeating the words in a higher register.
I suggest you start a little lower. You can't go higher from your top note.
He wants the prisoners to ascend the scale as they're speaking. Vandy demonstrates. Varnish.
That's lovely.
Varnish is reading these new rules from a sheet held in one hand, while in the other he holds his club. The rest of the guards are also caressing their clubs, except for Jeff L., whose continued presence makes no sense at all. As Varnish leads the prisoners in reciting the rules, Vandy, Saros, and Burdan move into and out of the cells, in and around the prisoners, looking for the missing handcuff keys, weapons, or anything suspicious.
Saros forces Sarge out of line and forces him to stand with his hands against the opposite wall, legs spread, as he blindfolds him. He then handcuffs Sarge, orders him to collect the refuse bucket, and then leads him to dump it in the toilet outside the prison. One after another, each prisoner shouts out, "The superintendent's!" as the answer to the question posed by Varnish. "Whose orders are supreme?" It's my turn on our early morning shift to tape record the key events while Kurt and Craig catch some shut-eye. Seems strange to hear this assertion that my orders are supreme. In my other life, I make it a point never to give orders, only suggestions or hints about what I want or need. Varnish eggs them on, forcing them to sing out, "Punishment!" as the last word in the rule about what happens if any of the other rules are not obeyed. They must sing the feared word at their highest pitch again and again to make them feel ridiculous and humiliated. This has been going on for nearly 40 minutes, and the prisoners are squirming. Their legs are getting stiff, their backs are aching, but none of them is complaining. Verdan orders the prisoners to turn around and face front for a uniform inspection. Then Vandy questions 1037 about why he doesn't have on his stocking cap.
"One of the guards took it away, sir."
Vandy:
"I don't know of any correctional officer who took it. Are you saying that the correctional officers really don't know what's happening?"
"No, I'm not saying that, Mr. Correctional Officer."
Vandy:
"So it was you who lost the cap?"
1037:
"Yes, I did, Mr. Correctional Officer."
Vandy:
15 push-ups.
Would you like me to count?"
Vandy makes it public that prisoner 3401 has been complaining of being sick. Varnish responds,
"We don't like sick prisoners. Why don't you do 20 sit-ups right now to make you feel better?"
He then accuses 3401 of being a crybaby and takes away his pillow.
"Okay, everyone who has a stocking cap, go back to your room. Those who don't, stand there. You can sit on your beds, but not lie down. Actually, make your beds. No wrinkles whatsoever."
Then Varnish orders synchronized group push-ups for the three bareheaded inmates. He jumps down off the table where he has been sitting as he bangs his billy club for emphasis. He stands over the prisoners shouting,
"Down! Up!"
as they do their punishment ritual. Paul 5704 stops, protesting that he just can't do any more. Varnish relents and allows the prisoners to stand up against the wall.
"Okay, you all stand by your beds until you find 3 stocking caps. If you're unable to find your stocking cap, put a towel on your head. 819, what kind of a day was it?"
"A wonderful day, Mr. Correctional Officer."
"Okay, make your beds without any wrinkles whatsoever. Then sit on them."
By this time, the other guards have left, and only the morning shift guards remain, including the backup guard, Morrison, quietly observing all this authoritarian abuse. He tells the prisoners that they can lie down if they wish, and they immediately hit the sack and are in dreamland almost instantly. An hour or so later, the warden stops by, looking very dapper in a tweedy jacket and tie. He seems to be growing a little each day, or maybe he is standing more erect than I can recall his standing in the past.
"Attention! Attention!" he intones.
"When the prisoners are properly attired, they should line up in the yard for further inspection."
The guards go to cells 2 and 3 and tell the prisoners to get up and go out into the yard. Once again, their brief nap is disrupted. Out come the occupants of cells 2 and 3 once more. Stu, 819, has found his stocking cap. Rich, 1037, is wearing a towel, turban style, while Paul, 5704, wears his towel in Little Red Riding Hood style, draped over his long black locks. Varnish inquires of Sarge,
"How did you sleep?"
"Wonderful, Mr. Correctional Officer."
5704 won't go that far and simply says,
"Good."
Varnish turns him to face the wall as another guard calls out a primary rule.
Prisoners must always address the guards as Mr. Correctional Officer.
5704 does push-ups for not having added that note of respect to his half-hearted lie, good. The warden walks slowly down the file of prisoners, like a general reviewing his troops.
This prisoner seems to have a problem with his hair, and he also seems to have a problem with proper identification. Before any further activity, he needs to be properly identified.
The warden moves down the line, evaluating the problem prisoners, and asks the guards to take necessary remedial action.
This prisoner's hair is sticking out underneath his towel.
He insists that the ID numbers be sewn back on or replaced by numbers inked on with a Sharpie pen.
Tomorrow is Visitor's Day. That means we want to show all our visitors what good-looking prisoners we have. Isn't that right? That means that prisoner 819 has to learn how to wear his stocking cap. I would suggest that at some future time, prisoners 3401 and 5704 be taught to wear their towels in the way that prisoner 1037 is wearing it. Now back to your cells.
The prisoners go back to sleep until awakened for breakfast. It's time for a new day, and the day shift comes on duty. A new count is tried out, this time cheerleader style, each prisoner cheering his number.
Give me a 5. Give me a 7. Give me an 0. Give me a 4. What does that spell? 5704.
Arnett and John Landry and Marcus are back with this new torment. Up and down the line, each prisoner steps forward to give this cheerleader rendition of his number. And on, and on, and... Identity and role boundaries are becoming permeable. After less than 3 days into this bizarre situation, some of the students role-playing prison guards have moved far beyond mere play-acting. They have internalized the hostility, negative effect, and mindset characteristic of some real prison guards, as is evident from their shift reports, retrospective diaries, and personal reflections. Saros is proud of the way the guards picked it up today, saying, "We were more orderly, received excellent results from the prisoners." Still, he is concerned about possible danger. Worried that the quietness may be deceptive, maybe plans for a breakout are afoot. Varnish reveals his initial reluctance to get into the guard role, which was so apparent that I had to get the warden to set him straight. It wasn't till the second day that I decided I would have to force myself to really go about this thing in the right way. I had to intentionally shut off all feelings I had towards any of the prisoners, to lose sympathy and any respect for them. I began to treat them as coldly and harshly as possible verbally. I would not let them show any feelings they might like to see, like anger or despair. His group identification had also become stronger. I saw the guards as a group of pleasant guys charged with the necessity of maintaining order among a group of persons unworthy of trust or sympathy, the prisoners. He notes further that the toughness of the guards peaked at tonight's 230 counts, and he likes that. Vandy, who has begun to share the dominant role with Varnish on the morning shift, is not as active today as earlier because he is very tired, feeling subdued from his lack of sleep. But he is pleased to see the prisoners getting so totally into their roles. They don't see it as an experiment. It is real, and they're fighting to keep their dignity. But we are always there to show them who is boss. He reports feeling increasingly bossy and forgetting that this is just an experiment. He finds himself just wanting to punish those who did not obey so that they would show the rest of the prisoners the right way to behave. The depersonalization of the prisoners and the spreading extent of dehumanization are beginning to affect him, too. As I got angrier and angrier, I didn't question this behavior as much. I couldn't let it affect me, so I started hiding myself deeper behind my role. It was the only way of not hurting yourself. I was really lost on what was happening, but didn't even think about quitting. Blaming the victims for their sorry condition, created by our failure to provide adequate shower and sanitation facilities, became common among the staff.
We see this victim blame in operation as Vandy complains, "I got tired of seeing the prisoners in rags, smelling bad, and the prison stink."
Safeguarding the security of my institution. In my role as prison superintendent, my mind has become focused on the most important issue facing the head of any institution. What must I do to ensure the safety and security of the institution in my charge? The threat to our prison by the rumored assault forced my other role as researcher into the background. How must I deal here and now with the impending break-in by 8612's party of raiders? Our morning staff meeting reviewed many options and settled on transferring the experiment to the old city jail, which was abandoned when the new central police station was completed, the one where our prisoners had been booked on Sunday. I remembered that the sergeant had asked that morning why we did not want to use the old jail for our study, since it was vacant and had large cells available. Had I thought of it before, I would have, but we had already put into place the recording equipment, arrangements with the university food service, and other logistical details that would be easier to handle from the psychology department's building. This new alternative was just what we needed. While I am away making arrangements for new facilities, Kurt Banks will handle the Prisoners' Grievance Committee's second meeting. Craig Haney will supervise the preparations for visiting times, and Dave Jaffe will oversee the day's usual activities of his correctional officers. I am pleased that the sergeant can meet me on such short notice. We meet in the old jail downtown on Ramona Street. I explain my predicament as the need to avoid a physical force confrontation, like the kind that happened last year when the police and students clashed on campus. I urge his cooperation. Together, we inspect the site, as though I were a prospective buyer. It is perfect for a transfer of the remainder of the study, and it will add even more prison realism to this experience. Back at police headquarters, I fill out a set of official forms and request that the jail be ready for our use by 9 that night, right after visiting hours. I also promise that for the next 10 days, we will keep it spanking clean, the prisoners will work at it, and I will pay for any damages that might occur. We make sure to shake hands with the firm shake that separates sissies from real men. I thank him profusely for saving the day. What a relief. That was easier than I had imagined. Relieved by this stroke of luck and proud of my quick thinking, I treat myself to a cup of espresso and a cannoli, soaking in some rays at the outdoor cafe on yet another balmy summer day. It is still paradise in Palo Alto. Nothing has changed since Sunday. Shortly after my celebratory staff briefing about our transfer plans, a disheartening call comes in from the police department. No go. The city manager is worried about getting sued if someone gets hurt while they're on the city property. Issues of false imprisonment are also raised. I begged the sergeant to allow me to try to persuade the city manager that his fears were unwarranted. I urge institutional cooperation, reminding him of my connection with Chief Zurcher. I plead for his understanding that someone is more likely to get hurt if there were to be a break-in at our low-security facility.
"Please, can't we work it out?"
"Sorry, but the answer's no. I hate to let you down, but it is purely a matter of business." I have lost my smart move for this righteous prisoner transfer, and clearly I am also losing my perspective. What must that police officer be thinking about a psychology professor who believes he is a prison superintendent, wildly fearful about some assault on his prison? Nutcase, maybe? Over the top? Likely. Psycho-psychologist? Probably. You know what? I told myself, who cares what he's thinking? Gotta move on. Time is pressing. Ditch that plan, move to another. First, put an informant into the prisoner mix to get better information about the impending riot. Then arrange to foil the rioters by pretending the study is over when they break in. We will disassemble the prison cells to make it look as though everyone has gone home, and I will tell them that we have decided to discontinue the research, So no heroics, just go back where you came from. After they leave, we will have time to fortify the prison and generate better options. We have found a large storage room on the top floor of the building where we would house the inmates right after visiting hours, assuming that the break-in does not occur during that time. Then, later that night, we will return them and fix up the prison so it will be more resistant to assault. Our shop technician is already working on ways to fortify the entrance doors, put up an outside surveillance camera, and enhance prison security in other ways. Seems like a sensible backup plan, no? Obviously, I was irrationally obsessed with the imagined assault on my prison. Planting an informer. We need more precise information about the impending attack, so I decide to put an informer into the jail, a presumed replacement for the released prisoner. David G. is a student of mine who had the kind of analytical mind we needed. Surely his big, bushy beard and unkempt appearance will endear him to the prisoners as one of their own. He had helped out earlier with videotaping during the initial stages of the study to relieve Kurt, and so had a sense of the place and the action. David agrees to participate for a few days and to give us whatever information he could glean that might be helpful. We will then have him sent to one of the staff offices on some pretext so he can spill the beans. Dave quickly discovers the guard's new doctrine, which one of them makes explicit. Good prisoners will have no cares. Troublemakers will have no peace. Most of the prisoners are in the process of deciding that it does not make sense to accept their prisoner role in its most contentious form by constantly opposing the guards. They are beginning to accept their fate and to cope day by day with whatever is done to them because the prospect of 2 weeks of hassling over sleep, meals, beds, and blankets was too much. But Dave notes a new mood that had not been present earlier. Paranoia strikes deep here, he later said about the rumors of escape. No one questions David's introduction into the study. Nonetheless, he feels that the guards know he is different from the others, but they aren't quite sure what he's doing there. They do not know his identity and simply treat him like all the others, badly. David is soon distressed over the bathroom routine. I had to shit in 5 minutes, to piss with a bag over my head while someone tells me where the urinal is. I couldn't do it. In fact, I couldn't even piss in the urinal. Had to go to the john and close it and know that somebody's not going to jump on me. He befriends Rich, 1037, his cell 2 mate. They quickly bond, but all too quickly. In a matter of hours, our trusted informer, David G., is transformed, wearing the old uniform of Doug 8612. Dave reports, feeling guilty being sent to rat on these great guys, and was relieved when there was really nothing to tell. But was there really no information to share? 1037 tells David that the prisoners cannot quit at any time. He goes on to advise him not to be as rebellious as he was in his first counts. It is not the best thing for them to do at this time. The way to plan an escape, 1037 confides, is to make the prisoners play along with the guards so that we can get them at their weak spot. In fact, David told us later that 8612 had not organized any escape plot at all. However, we had already wasted a lot of time and energy in preparing to blunt the attack. Sure, a few of these guys sort of dreamed of their friends coming during visitors' hours and busting them out, he said, or of slipping away during washroom breaks, but it was clear it was all a dream, a scrap of hope to hold on to. We gradually realize that David has violated his verbal contract with us to enact the informer role in this emergency. Accordingly, when someone steals the keys to the police handcuffs later that day, David tells us that he has no idea where they are. He had lied, as we learned from his diary report at the end of the experiment. I knew where the handcuff key was after a while, but didn't tell, at least not until it didn't matter anymore.
I would have told, but I was not about to betray these guys right out in front of them.
This rather sudden and amazing transformation into the prisoner mentality was even more evident in some of David's other feedback. He felt that during his 2 days in our jail, he was no different from the others, with the exception that I had knowledge of when I would get out, but even that knowledge became less and less certain since I was depending on people on the outside to get me out. I already hated this situation. And at the end of his first day in the Stanford County Jail, David, the informer, tells us, "I fell asleep that night feeling dirty, guilty, scared." Grievances are vented. The same committee of three prisoners that I met with earlier came armed with a long list of grievances that they had delivered to Kurt Banks while I was away dealing with the city police. The same three-prisoner team, headed by 5704, along with 4325 and 1037, were elected by all the prisoners. Kurt listened respectfully to their complaints. Among them, unsanitary conditions due to toilet restrictions, no clean water to wash hands before meals, no showers, fear of communicable disease, handcuffs and leg chain irons too tight, causing bruises and abrasions. They also wanted church services on Sundays. In addition, they requested the option of alternating the chain from one leg to the other, exercise opportunities, recreation time, clean uniforms, allowing prisoners to communicate between cells,